On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Call it a thumpin'. The president does. Both houses, it's official, gone to the Democrats. After weeks of wonder and worry, even among conservatives, about whether voters would step up and call the GOP to account for scandal and botched war and executive overreach, this week American voters did just that. Conservative George Will says Republicans' punishment was not excessive, given the disaster in Iraq. Liberal Paul Krugman hails voters' great revulsion as democracy redeemed. And you thought your vote didn't matter. But now what? Up next on Point, our weekly news roundtable takes on the towering news of the week, the national thumpin' of the GOP, and where the country goes now. Joining me now from Washington is Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor for Time.com. We're delighted to have her with us today. Anna Marie, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
With us from Chicago is Tom Bevin, co-founder and editor-in-chief of RealClearPolitics.com, a great campaign and politics watcher. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Tom and Anna.
Tom, Anna, Jack, off we go. Tom Bevin, first to you. All kinds of interpretation and analysis out of this. Here we are a few days later. We're at the end of the week now. We've seen this big turnover. What's your bottom line on this? What was said in this vote?
Well, I think even the president admitted that there was a huge vote against the war in Iraq. We saw that. We saw independents swing against Republicans. And that was sort of the big question leading into this, was whether Republicans could turn out their vote, and they did. Whether Democrats would show up the polls, and they did. And the question was, would independents show up, and would they break for Democrats? And they did. And so, you know, we'll see. I mean, President Bush is making sort of these public announcements that he's gotten the message. But we'll see how things go as we move ahead with a democratically controlled House and Senate.
Anna Marie Cox, we've got new majorities in both the House and Senate. Do we have a new political consensus in this country, or are we in some kind of interim state here?
I think we're in an interim state, definitely, a sort of liminal area, maybe. The big question in Washington, of course, is what Nancy Pelosi is going to do in controlling her new class. A lot has been made about how a lot of the new Democrats that are elected are fairly conservative, moderate Democrats. But the committee chairs she's going to be overseeing are fairly, you know, sort of traditional liberal Democrats.
And the old lions, the big old lions.
Right,
here.
Mm-hmm. Right. Charlie Rangel, Waxman, all these people who are raring at the bit to go after the Bush administration. It's going to be up to her, I think, to keep them in line and see if she can work out some kind of bipartisan agreement with the White House. Although I have to say, my read on the White House right now, they don't seem too friendly. I think they're kind of upset.
President Bush has been all smiles and talk about hospitality, new drapes for Nancy and all the rest.
He can be a very petty man. And I think this loss is hitting them hard. In part because, you know, both he and Karl Rove went out way out on limbs, prior to the election, saying that they were going to keep the House and the Senate. And that makes them look either out of touch or like they were lying.
Jack Beatty, what do you see here? A real turn to Democratic Party politics or into a kind of neutral zone, a national jump ball, forgive the sports metaphor, for the 08 presidency?
Well, a return to divided government, which does seem to be the American predisposition. These last years were an exception to recent history. And divided government has a very good track record. In the Reagan years, the Social Security Commission that stabilized the system, that was done with both parties. Tax reform in the Clinton years, welfare reform. Well, now there are three big issues that require parties to work together on. One, of course, is to get out of the catastrophe of Iraq, and if they can do it together, then you don't get the stab in the back myth, the right-wing myth that, you know, it was the liberals who did us in, and which is always a possibility. If Bush and the Democrats can do that together, of course, Bush may have to drop his notion of victory. It doesn't look like victory is in the cards. Second, Social Security. That's a subject the Democrats could demagogue and have. If Bush gives up on his private accounts, perhaps they could have private accounts outside of Social Security, then I think they can make some do some business on stabilizing the financing of that system. And third, immigration. The Democrats would, in fact, pass Bush's, or it looks like they would pass Bush's comprehensive immigration reform bill. If he wants that, he can get them with the, he can get that with the Democrats, as he could not with his own party.
And Jack, you're saying divided government works and Americans like it. It's been called a recipe for stalemate. You're saying not. Because why? They can share the credit and the blame?
That's it. That's it. And you can do very difficult things if both party if there's a will to do it. If only one party does it, and that was the recipe the House was following under Bush, then all of the credit or blame goes to them. And when you're dealing with something like Social Security, that both parties have to work together on that, because otherwise it'll allow the other party to make political hay on, you know, whoever was hurt by the deal.
We'll look ahead at those potential policy changes. But Tom Bevin, I've got to ask you, you've got a lot of conservative voices at your website, realpolitics.com, others as well, but you're in touch with this community. Dick Armey says the Republican revolution is dead. End of the revolution, he writes. Do you agree, or is it in abeyance here?
No, I think it's in abeyance. I would disagree with Anna a little bit in the sense that, you know, the White House, I mean, if you look at this, the control of the Senate, everyone, Republican strategists, even pretty much up and into including the White House, were privately acknowledging that the House was going to go down. But the Senate was much closer. And in fact, I mean, we're talking about 10,000 votes, 3,000 in Montana and 6,000 or 7,000 in Virginia that were essentially the balance of power. So it, in some ways, the president had it right at his press conference when he said this. There were a lot of close races out there, but on balance, it was a thumping. And so I think he's acknowledging that.
But what about the conservative movement and the wings that now seems in some way broken into? Do we have to now have, because of this defeat, does there have to be a repudiation by the Republican Party of what the party became since, you name it, 2000?
I wouldn't say there has to be a repudiation, but I do think there will be a real reevaluation of conservatism, the conservative movement, what it was supposed to be, what it's going to be in the future. The one thing, I mean, the conservative coalition that really propelled Bush to power was this sort of loosely aligned arrangement between sort of social conservatism and the fiscal conservatives and the libertarian wing of the party, and that has certainly fractured. I mean, you have libertarians were very disappointed in the Bush administration over spending. They were disappointed in some of the Terry Schiavo case, things like that. And you had fiscal conservatives that were upset over spending and immigration. I mean, there were a lot of disgruntled Republicans out there of various stripes. And I think what they're going to have to do after this election is sit down and work through some of those differences and try and repair that coalition if they can to move ahead.
Anna Marie Cox, what do you see that repair work looking like? What kind of internal knockdown, dragouts, fights, adjustments are the Republicans going to have to unfold here to clear the decks for an 08 run?
Well, I think one thing that's happening right now is we're sort of getting a consensus narrative among the conservatives about why they lost. Interestingly, I think that there's not a consensus that they lost because of Iraq simply. As Tom was saying, there's that coalition, that loose coalition that Bush was elected under, he managed to do something to upset each part of that coalition.
But you have George Will writing just today about Iraq is arguably, his words, the worst foreign policy disaster in U.S. history, and the punishment fit the crime, he says here, for the Republican Party.
I'll defer to Tom on this, but I would be willing to say that there are plenty of, like, rock-ribbed conservatives who don't think George Will speaks for them. Mm. He's been out on this Iraq war thing for a long time. He has been critical of it for quite some time. And I think that what's interesting to me is I see a narrative developing where conservatives are saying that the reason why the conservatives lost is because they weren't conservative enough.
This is the Newt Gingrich line already.
Right, exactly. And that they point to the losses of moderate Republicans. A lot of moderate Republicans were kicked out this past week, and say that's what needs to happen is a return to true conservative roots.
Jack,
Anna. Yeah, I'd be interested to know what Tom thinks of that. He's probably more in touch with that.
Let me ask you then: how does that square with what you describe as many describe as independents swinging this vote? If Republicans go back more conservative now, do they walk away from a middle ground they may need to carry?
Well, I mean, those things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, mm-hmm. There was, I think, some disgruntlement on the part of conservatives saying that Bush wasn't conservative enough, and that's with regard to spending and with regard to immigration. I think what the narrative that I see developing is people saying, listen, we need to go back to conservatives saying we need to go back to our sort of Goldwater, Reagan-esque, Western-style roots, which is, you know, start talking about individual freedom, start talking more about limited government.
A lot of victories and losses and looking ahead. Let's go to Ohio here for a second. So some tape from Democrat Sherrod Brown beating out Republican incumbent Senator Mike DeWine. In victory speech, Sherrod Brown reminded us that 2008 is just around the corner.
You and you and you, all of us together today have helped to change our country. And because of progressive principles, mainstream progressive values, as Ohio goes in 06, so goes the nation in 08.
And there, right away, looking at 08, even on victory night, Tom Bevin, you've been looking at Ohio numbers. What do you make of Sherrod Brown's assertion there?
Well, I mean, that was one of the things. Democrats were very much in hopes of getting some of those key swing states, both at the senatorial level, but also at the governorship level, and they did that in Ohio. So that could, you know, help on the margins as we look ahead to 08. It's interesting, Tom Vilsack announced he waited an entire 36 hours before announcing that he's going to run for president.
Iowa governor, right? He's right there. But you've also noted Republican survivors in Ohio, Tom.
I did, actually. I mean, that was one of the interesting things. Republicans really took a beating to the west of Ohio in Indiana. When this whole thing started, Ohio was one of the GOP's biggest concerns, not only because of the governorship and the senatorial race, but they had four House seats on the block, including Bob Nay's seat, which everyone agreed was gone. Mm-hmm. But they had three very endangered Republican incumbents, Steve Shabbat in the 1st District, Gene Schmidt in the 2nd, and Deborah Price in Ohio 15. Despite the fact that Republicans to the west in Indiana got swept and Republicans in the east in Pennsylvania lost four out of five House seats, including a surprise in Melissa Hart in the western Pennsylvania 4, which is right on the border of Ohio, Shabbat, Schmidt, and Price all survived. So that was very interesting.
Although there's a recount with two of those, right? The Price race and the Schmidt race.
I believe there are. Schmidt won by about 2,300 votes. Price was up about 3,300 votes. So I believe there are recounts going on.
That shows one of the dangers of what we've been talking about on this show for a long time, that gerrymandering as a way of resisting the Democrat, you know, the popular will, because, of course, that Ohio legislature has gerrymandered those districts such that it would be very difficult for even a big Democratic tide in that state to carry those districts. But you know what happened in Ohio is potentially of immense importance to the entire presidential map. You add Ohio to the states Kerry carried, he's the president. And in 2008, the Democrats don't have to win anything in the South if they just hold on to the seats he took and take Ohio. And so if the headline in the Columbus Dispatch the other day, Ohio turns blue, if it stays blue, the Democrats have a much better, in fact, their best chance at the White House in a long time.
Anna Marie Cox, let me ask you about Sherrod Brown's assertion here, the new Democratic senator from Ohio, saying that what this vote portends is mainstream progressive values, as he calls them. Mainstream progressive values will decide the presidential election in 08. On the other hand, we've got a lot of people saying, no, this is about the middle muscling in. David Brooks's headline. How do you interpret progressive, mainstream progressive,
I
the middle?
That phrase actually caught my attention as well. I mean, I wonder who crafted it. It's kind of brilliant.
It's kind
but
of
I'm
a straddle.
Sure. It's kind of brilliant, but I'm not sure if it's exactly going to be saleable. I think that it is true that the Democrats did well in this cycle because they were able to turn themselves into a much bigger tent party than they have been in the past. They had Bob Casey, you know, a right to life pro gun person in Pennsylvania. They had all these Western Democrats. I was actually interested when Tom said something about returning to their Western Goldwater roots. It seems actually that the Democrats are doing a better job of that.
Mm-hmm.
The people that they have running in the West in Montana and elsewhere sound a lot like, you know, Goldwater Republicans in some ways. They talk a lot about individual liberty. They talk about a lot of personal responsibility. In fact, you know, one of the things that I haven't heard talked about a lot, but one of the most interesting things that happened on Tuesday was North Dakota's overturning an abortion ban. And that campaign was very interesting because it was not a traditional sort of pro-choice kind of outreach. What they said was you don't want the government controlling your body. They said you don't want the government making a decision instead of you and your doctor. You don't want other people from out of the state to come in and make our laws, which is what happened in North Dakota. They had
trying to produce a test case that would go to the Supreme Court with the legislature banning abortion, and voters said, no thanks, we won't go all the way to that.
Exactly. I thought that was really interesting and a really interesting twist on some traditionally liberal talking points and turning them into something that, you know, mainstream people could embrace.
Where's the new center? What's the new thrust here? Or is the center what matters now after years of base politics, partisan politics? Tom, Anna, Jack, I want to turn to our listeners. Kay is calling from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hi, Kay. You're on the air.
Thanks very much for taking my call. I'm with a group called Military Family Speak Out, and I was actually in D.C. yesterday, and I'm on my way back now, and we had arranged some time back to meet with Donald Rumsfeld. Of course, he never agreed. And it's crazy because when we were planning it, someone said, well, what if the day after the election he's gone? And we were like, yeah, right.
What did you want to tell him, Kay? What's your message?
This is what we want to tell him. Number one, the war needs to end now. And if you're going to continue the war, what they're doing, this is our biggest, most utmost complaint, is this stop-loss backdoor draft. And I don't know if people understand what it is, but my husband was National Guard. They just got back from Iraq, from Ramadi, Iraq, in June. We have families. One family has three kids and two grandkids that keep rotating through. Not one time, not two times, three times.
Nobody can get out. Back and back and back you go. They say, do you think the Democrats will change the policy? Will get the troops out? Is that what you want?
Let me tell you, we went to the House and the Senate, to everybody on the Armed Services Committee. And when I went to Democrats, I told them, I said, okay, I'm going to cut you some slack because I realized that this Republican Congress kept you out. But you have no excuse now. None. You know, I mean, we've spent money and it's wasted. We've lost lives and it's wasted. And to have another soldier die for a war that was lies and corruption is appalling. And I also talked to one of the assistants because, of course, nobody was there yesterday. And I said, I really want them impeached. And he said, ma'am, that'll never happen. And I'm thinking about it. I was like, all right, I'll give that up, you know, end the war. But can we sanction him? Can we pull Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, all of them?
Nobody was there, but you were there, Kay, and we can hear what you brought when you came. Tom Bevin, how about it? Here's a military family, a group of military families saying, we want something done. We want these troops out of there. They're being ground to pieces, you know, cycled back and back and back and back. Do you see that happening? We already heard James Webb on NPR this morning saying what he's looking forward to is the James Baker plan, the same thing that the president's looking forward to. So are there two visions now of the road ahead or one?
Well, look, I think the caller illustrates exactly Nancy Pelosi's problem. I mean, she's got a left wing of her party that is, you know, wants to impeach the president, wants to get out of Iraq now. I don't think that's what necessarily certainly those people voted Democrat on Tuesday. Now, I don't think that's necessarily what independents voted for. They did vote Democrat. But I think one of the things that they were voting for was out of frustration with this president. I think Bush really, over the last 2 years, sort of reached his limit of his inability to communicate to the public what's going on in Iraq, what we're doing. And obviously the news didn't help. And, you know, that sort of played itself out. But, I don't think that Nancy Pelosi going on to impeach the president is going to in any way help the Democrats. I mean, that would be that was what everyone was talking about before this election. It could be they were saying this is the Republicans' dream to have Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. Well, we're going to see whether that's true or not, or whether she can sort of find some common ground using the Baker report and some other things. Not get too over the top on investigations, but to both appease the left-wing base of her party and also satisfy the independents and centrists who voted against Iraq.
Jack, Anna Marie, what do you think?
Yeah, but, you know, it isn't just the left wing of the Democratic Party that wants to get out of Iraq. If you put people who want out now and people who want out by the end of the year or so, you've got a majority. You're nearly into the 60%. That isn't just something left-wingers want. And I think what this woman was saying to these people is what millions of Americans are saying. Why are these people dying in a civil war in Iraq? I mean, what is the point of this now? We have done our job. We have got rid of the dictator. He's going to be hung. Mission accomplished. And if these people can't defend themselves, if they have no will to bridge their differences, it isn't our part to stand between them. And that recognition, I think, is going to grow. What I fear is that the Baker plan, whatever it'll be, will leave a rump force in Iraq, and they will be more vulnerable because they'll have less force protection. And essentially, we'll all live with the fact that, 200, 300, whoever it might be, young men and women every few months will get killed in Iraq. And that, I think, would just be horrifying.
Anna Marie Cox, how do you see this? Because, of course, there's the war, there's the death toll. It's every day. You hear the urgency from our caller Kay. On the other hand, there's 08, and people don't want to be seen as, you know, defeatists.
Well, there's two things. One thing is I do think that the worst thing that Nancy Pelosi could do for the Democratic Party in order to gain the presidency in 08 would be to impeach the president or to go overboard on investigations.
She said she won't, hasn't she?
I know. I believe that she won't. But and then to go, I think Jack actually articulated very, very well what's kind of the most mainstream objection to the war, which is kind of a frustration with not understanding, like, why this is still happening. And I think that also Tom is right, that he said the president was just stopped being able to communicate it, and in the pictures and the headlines were so bad. I think the really distressing news for both Democrats and Republicans that want to solve the problem in Iraq is that John McCain may be right. William Kristol may be right. We may need more people there. That may be the only way that we're going to get a handle on the situation. And it's in that's something that obviously people like the caller are not going to be happy with. But it also might be I think a popular kind of refrain among moderate Democrats and I guess some conservatives as well is that, you know, this was an illegal war. It was a wrong war to get into. We really messed up. Everything's bad, but we can't leave.
But there's the gulf between out now and more troops, and that is a big one. Let me take another caller, Andy, from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You guys just hit on my topic.
What do you got, Andy?
I definitely voted for a change to get these people out for many reasons, but I am concerned that we could blow it if we focus our attention on getting back at these people. And frankly, I would like to see impeachment, but I don't agree with the cost of it. I don't want to pay the cost of impeachment. I think we might have to let it go, or I would like to wait a few years and then go after him. But we really need to lead. The Democrats really have to show some leadership and solve some problems first. Otherwise, it's just going to backfire.
Andy, we've got it. Let's listen to the president for a moment here. He spoke about this right up front this week. He's saying, well, here he is on what he wants from the Democrats and what might not work.
See, if the goal is success, then we can work together. If the goal is get out now, regardless, then that's going to be hard to work together.
You know, we're not going to solve Iraq right here, right now, but I want to ask all three of you about the president and the about-face this week in terms of attitude. Last week it was Tom Bevin along the lines of, you know, elect Democrats and you're electing and the terrorists win. This week it's all, you know, sunshine and garlands, or kind of, in the White House. What do you make of President Bush's sort of turning his tone on a dime here? How do you interpret that?
Well, I mean, he was obviously in the heat of the election battle.
That heat lasted a long time then. You know, I mean, he's been pretty tough, just about as out there as you can be in criticizing the party for years.
Well, in the last couple of weeks, some of the things he said on the stump obviously were very hard-edged, as were some of the things that were being said about him from the other side. I mean, that's just sort of how elections go. I think he is trying to moderate his position and put on a happy face, a bipartisan face. Again, I don't know that that's necessarily what we're going to see on his side or on the Democrat side. I mean, it's the really interesting thing about moving ahead is how this all it becomes a chess game for 2008. Bush has already put up just yesterday or this morning renomination of John Bolton. Mm-hmm. He's pushing on the NSA wiretap thing. He wants to force Democrats to smack both of those things down. Because that'll help Republicans. And Nancy Pelosi's already said she's going to push ahead with a minimum wage increase, and she's health care, immigration, stem cells, things that will, she's going to want to force Republicans to go on record and vote against those things. And those are the last two, immigration and stem cells, are something that could really help split the Republican base.
Anna Marie Cox,
so it's going to be very interesting.
This is a president who has not governed from the center. So can he do it now? Everyone cites his old Texas time. I mean, that would be some kind of born-again presidency if he really was suddenly a centrist.
Yes, it would. I agree. I think that, and there's a lot of people trying to sort of just parse what exactly happened in Texas and figure out if that was something that he did, because it's in his nature to be that kind of conciliatory or at least trying to, you know, compromise person, or if it was just a pragmatic decision from our MBA president that this was a new reality and he had to work with it. He is our MBA president. He can be very pragmatic about some things, but after 6 years of not having to compromise on so many things, one wonders if he's going to be able to regain that habit again. And I say the immediate reaction of the White House, according to people at Time, Mike Allen did a great piece for us, said, had people inside the White House saying, you know, they don't feel very conciliatory right now, and they don't think that's going to work. And I have to say that there are some things. Both sides have made these wonderful noises about wanting to reach across the aisle on issues, but they're kind of talking past each other. The president says, well, I want to work with you on you know, Social Security reform. Mm-hmm. And Nancy Pelosi says, well, I want to work with you in getting out of Iraq. So right. they can both make an argument and say, no, I reached out. I reached out on this issue, and they pushed me away.
Bill's calling right now from Bethlehem, Connecticut. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Bill, how are you? Thank you for taking my call there, Tom.
We're good. What do you see, Bill?
What I'm upset, I'm a registered Republican, and I voted for the first time in my life straight Democratic ticket.
Even for Lamont? You didn't go for fighting Joe Lieberman there, the new independent?
I didn't go for Joe because he's been in there too long, and I feel it was time for a change.
So what made a straight ticket Democrat out of you this time, Bill?
Well, there are a couple of things. Of course, the war is a disaster, which we've all been talking about, but also is that I feel the Christian right has taken too much control of the Republican Party, and I think religion should be out of politics, even though I'm a Christian. It just seems they have moved in and muscled in the party. And also I feel that the Bush administration, or George Bush himself, has given the middle class crumbs. He's basically a rich man's president, and it's come off to me is that he just throws the middle class some crumbs, and he doesn't really care for the middle class at all. He's a rich man's president.
So there's a Republican talking tough with his own party. Bill, you've put two good ones on the table for us. Tom Bevin, let's look at these. And first, the religious right. Where does it stand after this election? Its influence in the GOP, up, down, sideways, and its role going forward?
Well, I would say, you know, ironically, Bill's vote to knock out a bunch of moderate Republicans in the Northeast enhanced the influence of the religious right by leaving sort of, you know, no moderate Republicans left in the party. I mean, that's something that happened this election that, you know, could potentially invigorate the Christian right or give them more power.
You don't
less.
Think Republicans elsewhere around the country will move toward the center trying to follow this vote? Are they still going to stay in the embrace of the Christian right that Bill's worried about?
No, not necessarily. Like I said earlier, I think there is a very strong libertarian strain in the party that's going to exert its influence now and reach back into the center. But I'm just saying, as a practical matter, Bill's vote as a Republican wanting to see the Christian right have less influence, he may have in fact gotten just the opposite, because a lot of moderate Republicans in the Northeast were knocked out this round, and those are going to be really tough districts to get back.
But that influence of the Christian right has not exactly been eroding by voting those Republicans in election after election, Tom.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think the influence of the Christian right has eroded over the last few election cycles just sort of on its own. But again, you know, if you have I mean, that's one of the results of a further polarized Congress that we're going to have.
Anna Marie Cox, how do you see the religious right after this big vote, this big turnover?
I wonder if they want to have as big an influence. I mean, perhaps they do, but you are hearing some religious right leaders of the religious right saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't be as involved in politics. You know, it's a corrupt atmosphere. They haven't actually done that much for the right. People forget that. And also, we were talking about the insurance, the backlash insurance against that the Republicans are hoping for
Jack
on social
Scott,
issues.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's really interesting. You know, a lot of these very conservative cultural issue ballot initiatives wound up passing, and the Democrats still got elected. In Virginia, they passed an anti-gay marriage amendment, but elected Jim Webb. I think that what this election showed is that if there's enough bitterness, enough acrimony, you can lead those value voters to the polls, you know, but you can't make them vote for the conservative candidate.
Jack, we'll look at the economy and wages in just a second, but what about this religious right piece? And look forward to the presidential election 08. Is that going to be a big prize once again for the GOP candidate, or kid gloves a little distance? What do you expect, Jack?
Well, you know, it's 24%. It was 24% of the electorate this time, white evangelical, born again. That's a big slice. Mm-hmm. And 71% of them voted for Republican. That's a big part of the Republican base. So I think the Republicans cannot possibly ignore these people. And in a way, you know, this is the populist part of the Republican Party. I mean, I agree with our caller from Bill from Connecticut. Bush is a president for millionaires, but he's also, or at least he's been thought to be, a president for people who are just fed up with the modern world and with many of the aspects, with the valuelessness, with the nihilism, with all the rest, and they make their protest through these organizations. And I think the Republicans, at their peril, would give up, would try to, you know, step away from their populist base out there.
Have the Democrats found a keyhole into that concern over lack of values and right on down in this election,
or
are they redefining what that means somehow?
I think they have, and it's in the Catholic vote. John Kerry lost it in the election. First of all, I don't think the Democrats should ever and will ever for a long time nominate another Catholic for president, because that just makes the whole issue with the hierarchy so fraught. But the Democrats took the Catholic vote, 56-44, and that is a values vote in many places. That's a vote about the middle class, about the minimum wage. It's a vote about economic inequality. It's a vote about fairness. Those are the traditional Catholic social values that I think in an election where the cultural values were recessive, those were able to come out. If the Democrats hold on to the Catholic vote, then they can have a governing majority, it seems to me.
Tom Bevin, in Chicago, you know that this rich man's president kind of idea has had some power here. The economy, if you look at the growth numbers, unemployment numbers, not half bad at all in this election, and still it wasn't swaying enough votes to put the GOP back into these seats. What might happen to change that? Will the GOP change its stripes somehow on this? What might the Democrats do to act on the kind of concern that Bill raises here from Connecticut, that the economy is not working for the middle class?
Well, I think that's one of the things. I mean, obviously, the economy, by most measures, is doing great, and yet President Bush and the Republicans got virtually no credit for that in this election.
Well, you heard why right there. People don't believe
primarily,
it's for everybody.
Two things. Primarily, Iraq was the dominant issue, certainly much more so than the economy. And also, there is some concern about wage growth, and how the middle class, the progress that's been made in the economy is benefiting those in the middle class. I would say, going back to the last point that was made about the referendums and what Jack said, I think, you've seen socially conservative referendums on the ballots in a lot of states over the last few cycles, and they've all passed with majority support, overwhelming majority support in some cases. And those are not all just conservative white evangelicals coming to the polls. I mean, the country is still largely culturally conservative on some of these issues. So I think that's something that's one of the things that Democrats did very well this time was they fielded a slate of candidates which were very well suited to the electorate in which they were running. Jim Webb in Virginia, Harold Ford in Tennessee, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, and also John Tester in Montana.
Honorary request, we've got a couple of balls in the air here. I don't want to let the economy piece go first. I mean, Democrats are already talking about raising the minimum wage. Some Republicans raising their hand for that as well, but clearly that's not enough to change the dynamic that our caller was talking about. What about the inequality issue? Can you see concrete steps being taken in the next 2 years to address it? Do you see it as coming up as a major issue in the presidential election in 08?
Well, it depends on how far, I guess, John Edwards gets. He's still using that to America's soundbite and in running on that issue. I think the minimum wage thing is going to play a much bigger role than perhaps we would have thought, 6 months ago. I have heard conservatives say that maybe they should just go ahead and endorse that as a way to get the issue off the table, as a way to keep, because that referendum did work to bring out progressive voters and Democrat voters in this last cycle.
Well, it's quite a symbol sitting it there at $5 and change year after year after year, while the bonuses on Wall Street are $40 million.
Exactly. And so if Republicans could just make a decision, saying, this is not disastrous for us to just go ahead and embrace this idea, and then they would take that issue away from the Democrats. It could work out very well for them and allow them to run on some economic, injustice sort of at least put that spin out there. I think that Democrats have been burned in the past in trying to, when they try to talk about economic inequality, mm-hmm. it gets redefined as a class war.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had such great luck running these very, very, very centrist talking Democrats in this last cycle. Harold Ford, John Tester, exactly the people that Tom was mentioning, to bring back the rhetoric of economic inequality, I think, would take a really masterful politician to do that. I'm not sure if the Democrats have that kind of masterful politician waiting in the wings right now.
And yet there's energy around it if they could find a way to tap it. I mean, it sits in people's real lives. Let me get a call here from Silver Spring, Maryland. Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I've been a hardcore Republican most of my life, and I just wanted to explain the reasons why I totally changed my mind on Tuesday.
Okay.
Basically, I was convinced by the Military Times and by seeing a wounded veteran my age on the bus, and not so much being as dismayed by the wounding, but just ultimately wondering why the party that I have been defending from, you know, most of my friends for years hasn't been delivering on the promises that I really, you know, I really had faith in them. I really did. I wanted to see things change. I really believed in the whole democracy in Iraq business. And I was just tickled pink. I was like, not only did the Democrats take over things, but they also, the immediate responsiveness of Bush was really kind of shocking to me. Like, I really expected anything else but an immediate firing of Rumsfeld and the sort of contrite tone in his voice when he said that he received a thumping.
So where do you look going forward then, Chris? Are you now looking to the new party or still waiting to judge?
No, I think that that both parties have a real opportunity here. That I think that the contest has to change just for pure logical, tactical reasons. It has to change from hate to love. They have to kind of out-nice each other now if they want to have a real shot at remaining, you know, relevant.
Well, clearly, people want things to turn up. They want to see things moving in a better direction. Chris, thanks for that call. Let me get one from Newport, Rhode Island. William is on the line. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, the one thing I wanted to say and I wanted to focus on was in the preamble of the Constitution, it says promote the general welfare. And that's what the people are resenting. They feel neglected. It's not the war. It's the entire general welfare. They feel it 100%. You talk to any worker, he doesn't believe the figures that are coming out of Washington as to the way the economy is humming along smoothly. He doesn't believe them. He believes they're being filtered. They're being adjusted. He doesn't believe the conversations from these born-again Christians. He believes there's no reality in that. He believes the moderates, the independents, are the only ones that know how it should go, and that he's not a no one is, that was a Republican that voted for Democrats is for the Democrats. They're just for change. They want somebody responsible and committed to America, and they feel it economically. Everybody I talk to, rich or poor, can feel the economics of the fact that they're not succeeding, that there's some stagnation at hand here, and they don't believe anybody that's in charge.
William, I think you're channeling a lot of the country right there. Jack, what do you say?
Yeah, you know, Paul Krugman calls this the great disconnect, the disconnect between the numbers and the reality. And, you know, that points to something. I mean, the American answer has been the market will take care of everything. Rising tide will lift all boats. It's not happening. It hasn't been happening. It's lifting the topmost boats. It's putting the people who are rich even richer, and it's doing very little because of the pervasive economic insecurity for people in the middle. If the market isn't doing it, what will? Now, this, of course, would call on the Democrats to really get serious about inequality. They would have to talk about finding ways to hinder the hindrances that stand in the way of people in realizing their purposes.
But you're not talking great society all over again, are you, Jack? I mean, there's also a lot of buy-in to the market dynamic, even as we see its failings.
Well, I understand, but I'm saying that what has made the market and American capitalism so successful is that it has adapted, and now mm-hmm. we're in a situation where it's prolific of inequality because something isn't working right, and that requires some kind of government intervention. Now, whether the Democrats can do it or even speak to it is another question entirely, but I completely agree with this caller. This feeling of this economy isn't about me, it's fixed, it's for the few. This is a ruinous feeling, and more Americans share it, and I think it's going to shadow the 2008 election.
Let me get one more call from Columbia, South Carolina. Matt's on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
We're good. What do you know?
I really agree with the last caller as the middleman and everything, because I kind of voted like for some Democrats and some Republicans
okay.
at the time.
Yeah.
But unless they raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour or to $15 an hour, it's not going to make a difference. It's not. I'm making $10 an hour right now, and I'm not even living. You know. Mm. And the biggest thing too is health care. Well, you know, it's the old saying: we can put a man on a moon, but we can't have. But everybody in this country doesn't have health care, and I don't mean like waiting 9 years for an MRI. I mean, this country can give everybody health care right now.
Matt, we hear it. Our time is short. But you want the $15 minimum wage. Tom Bevin, where does this energy go as we look toward 08, as we look toward the next 2 years?
Well, it'll be, as I said, I mean, Democrats now have a responsibility to govern. They didn't really put forward necessarily a plan. They ran sort of on the hopes that there would be a vote for change, and there was. So they will, I think Nancy Pelosi said, look, she's going to put the minimum wage forward. They will also address
the $7 and change, but here's the caller says, more, please.
That's right. That's right. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it's a very tricky thing, though. I mean, if the Democrats push like a Hillary type, you know, Hillary care, national health care plan, that could backfire. If they let some tax cuts elapse, Republicans are going to hit them as raising taxes. So it's going to be a very tricky political environment for them moving ahead to try and, you know, address some of these concerns that the middle class obviously has with the economics.
Anna Marie Cox, our time grows short, but I just want to address the buoyancy that I'm feeling in the air this week. And oddly, on both sides of the aisle, even though Republicans took some losses here, a kind of feeling of a fresh air, some oxygen in the room that wasn't here a week ago.
I think that's probably true. I think that they're, you know, you hear the conservative talk show host saying they're glad they're not going to have to defend these people anymore. So definitely, like, the right is sensing a time for change. The left is sensing, like, an opportunity to finally, you know, be able to govern. I think the bar is unnaturally high for the Democrats, considering what a disaster they have left in their hands, or they've inherited. But I it's going to be a great time to be covering politics. I'm really looking forward to it.
Jack Beatty, democracy redeemed, or still a little life support here going on?
Well, I don't want to sound partisan, but I think democracy was redeemed in the sense that you have to have accountability. Nobody thinks that this was a successful Congress. 16% rating in the polls. Mm. If they weren't turned out of office, that would be a defeat for democracy. So yes, I think democracy, if not redeemed, then what? It earned its keep.
It's perking up this week. Well, a big turnover, a new vista, a fascinating one. Lots of question marks out there. Anna Marie Cox, I think you're exactly right. It's going to be something to cover. Anna Marie, thanks very much for being with us today. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor for Time.com. Tom Bevin in Chicago at RealClearPolitics.com. Tom, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack, always great to have you. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.